Hey, I really enjoyed both your guys' pieces. Thought they were well done. My question was, how many drafts did you guys have to go through until it was, like, perfect, or how you want it to be, like, in its final state to be sent down to the world?
For me, it was like this process that happened so fast for this semiotext book. I proposed the idea to do the book, and then in a year, it was, you know, literally in the world. So basically, from the time that I went to semiotext because they had asked me to do this book for them like 5 or 6 years ago, I was like, oh, I've got like 3 or 4 essays that I think could be the semiotext book. And they're like, okay, send it to us. Oh, yeah, this would be great. Maybe write an introduction or something. And then I more than doubled the manuscript in like half a year. And it wasn't necessarily that I was just like obsessively revising. I was just generating new stuff for the book and then trying to figure out a way to fit the essays together. So I ended up writing a really lengthy introduction where I tried to get to, or tried to create a framework for understanding the essays like holistically and, you know, showing how they fit together. And I sent the manuscript to some people, and I got some feedback, like Francesca, who's here, read the introduction when it was in its draft form. But it was a very fast process. I would have liked to have had like more intensive editorial feedback, but mostly it was like, it went through a lot of drafts with just proofreading, because that's the thing about making a book, no matter how many times you read it, there are always typographical mistakes to catch. So, yeah.
Okay, so my book started like at a very definitive date. The first essay was written on my 33rd birthday, and I wrote an essay about it, and that's the start of the book, because like the internet remembered my birthday, but my boyfriend didn't, and I was really bitter about that. And so I wrote an essay, and it was the first time I wrote about my sister's death. And then I wrote another essay about rats and captivity, and then I saw these two pieces, and I was like, what does, oh, there's a dragon in the birthday essay. So I was like, what does a dragon and a rat have in common? I was like, well, obviously the Chinese zodiac. Which no one else would ever think that. Well, maybe you would. I don't know. But it made sense in my brain. So then I had the structure of the book, which was 12 essays, and each essay would contain one of the animals of the zodiac. And then I finished writing the book in... it took me about a year to write the book, and then I won a grant to go read the book to Ricky Ducournay, which is in the book, essay you heard. And I read the first essay on rats in captivity. And she's like, Lily, this is genius. This is great. And I was like, awesome. She's going blind. That's why I had to read the book to her. And then I read the second essay, and she was like, And then I read the third essay, and she was like, And then I read the fourth essay, and she was like, stop. This book is totally self-serving and self-pitying, and nobody wants to hear you whine about your life for 250 pages. And I was like, yeah, that's real. Okay. And then, so I was like, okay, I'm going to rewrite this book. And I came up with this whole strategy on what I was going to do and how I was not going to disappoint Ricky and embarrass myself to the world. And then I got home, and I found out that it won a book contest, that Wayne Kastenbaum had chosen this book that Ricky just eviscerated to win this book contest. And I wrote to the editor and I asked if I could revise the book, like really revise it. And she said, sure. And this was mid-July, July 15th or so. And she said, okay, cool. Just deliver me the manuscript by September 1st. And I was like, all right. And so I rewrote the entire book. Like I rewrote, there are maybe 10 pages in common from the original version to this one that's printed. And actually my tenure file was also due on September 1st. And so I was given this, like, real choice. Do you want to get tenure, or do you want to write a good book? And I chose to write a good book.
But you still got tenure.
But I still got tenure, so it's like happy ending.
I did.
But I wrote, so the way that I broke it down was that I wanted to give myself 5 days to write the last essay, and I wanted to give myself a week to sit on it before, like, revising. So that gave me 3 days to write each essay in the book. So I read one day, I wrote another day, and I revised the third day. And that's, like, every single essay in that book did that. Except for the last essay, again, which took 5 days. Yeah. So that's it. It was a long, but not long, and, like, really arduous, terrible process. Where I didn't sleep.
Revising is agonizing. It's like pulling teeth.
Yeah. Oh, and the blurb on the back of the book by Wayne Kastenbaum is for the first version of this book. I wrote to him, I was like, hey, I rewrote the book. Do you want to re-blurb it? He's like, no, I think it's cool.
Hi. In both your works, I noticed a lot of allusions to other media forms and specifically music, works by other authors. And I was just wondering how your creative process is influenced by other forms of art and other forms of media outside of poetry and outside of essays and short form writing. Mm.
Okay. I am a failed musician. So I like a good Asian daughter, played the piano and the violin, and I was very good. Like, I played in the Sydney Opera House when I was 17. Like, I was really into music. But then I realized that I wasn't good enough to get into, like, a top conservatory. So I quit. And I, like, became a writer. So yes, writer, like, music influences me a great deal. Because of that. But in terms of other media, I only recently started to watch things again. Like, watching things is a very new development for me. It's actually very entertaining. Like, television and movies, really entertaining, guys. If you don't watch things, you should totally check it out.
I think people are, like, sufficiently media saturated.
Oh, okay.
I dabble with other different forms. I do film and music. I often do multimedia performances where I use my K-Oscillator to make music while I read.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's a touchpad synthesizer. It's really fun. It's like my pet. Bring it around with me.
When she came to South Africa, Her K-Oscillator took up half of the, like,
the suitcase.
The suitcase.
It's like, kind of, hard to haul around. but yeah, so I do film and I do music. And I like to create writing soundtracks to cultivate the right vibe for me and, like, try to plug into the vibration when I'm writing. I love like going to the movies and watching films. I would just live in the movie theater if I could. I write about films sometimes, or I just, like, you know, bounce my words off of films. In like some essays, I'll like weave in like stills from films. For me, it's like, what I really like about making films is trying to express something not using words, and I love it, even though I don't do it enough. But yeah, I would also say that other writers, filmmakers, I always feel like I'm in conversation with whatever I'm consuming in the moment.
So just to start off, are both of you based in California, like for with your writing and everything?
I am. I teach at UC San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
I am living in Somerville, Massachusetts.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Not California.
Not California. I wish. It's like the weather is much better.
I'm trying to dream up a way to get Jackie a job with me.
I'm like, please let me be your spousal hire.
Yeah, I'm like, like, when I go up for promotion, I'm going to be like, I need to sign this amazing young scholar, Jackie Quay, as part of my promotion package.
Yeah. Wow. It would be great to be based out of California. My little brother is based out of Oakland, though.
Oh, okay, that's why.
Yeah, I've only been here since August, and I love California. This place is incredible.
Oh, okay. Well, I was going to ask if, since you were both in California, your brother's here, was like, what is the difference in like creative writing scenes that you guys are seeing between San Diego and like up here in San Francisco or maybe Los Angeles, like residually and stuff like that?
Yeah, I don't really know yet because, I mean,
Because you just got in here in August.
We just got here.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I can't say, and I really only know San Diego right now. I haven't been to the lit scene in LA much, but one of my presses is in LA, Le Figue. But my program doesn't have genre, so I think that means something. Like, we just don't, there's no genre.
That's cool.
How does that work out at the university? What do you guys talk about in courses and things like that?
Well, that's only the grad program. So the MFA program has no genre, so we workshop everything as one, in one group. At the undergrad level, there is the regular, traditional breakdown of fiction, nonfiction, poetry.
Okay, for sure. Thank you.
I only have an outsider perspective on it. Like, it seems like in LA, the art scene looms large over everything. And it's like, it's cool when artists are in conversation with visual artists. I personally have an aversion to the art world, so... But it is cool to get, you know, when you get a chance to engage visual art. And I think in terms of, and this is just my sense as an outsider, but I think, you know, Occupy Oakland, the student movement in the Bay Area really changed the, like, aesthetic sensibility as well. But like I said, this is just my sense as an outsider, but I think it's cool that this place generates a lot of work that is you know, embedded in political struggle.
Yeah. I wish San Diego had more of that, but we're just too busy being on the beach.
I understand. I'm from San Diego, that's why I'm asking. I'm like, should I go home?
I mean, it's beautiful weather year round. What can I say?
Thank you.
My question is actually more for Jackie. So, long time listener, first time caller to your work. Not necessarily, but I was thinking about around the time that I met you, we were both performing in LA, and you did this amazing live film narration piece to RoboCop with your Chaos Later.
Yeah.
And how when we were like curating the show, we were like, wait, why does Jackie want to do a piece to RoboCop? And then you did this amazing piece, and then you mentioned it being a part of your book, which I have yet to read, but I'm very much looking forward to. But something that has always struck me tremendously about your work is how personal it is, like, while being remarkably like revolutionary and political. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about like that old adage, the personal is political.
Yeah, gosh.
Sorry.
I was just thinking, like, I was formed in the crucible of like the punk scene, where it was like what you did was make purrzines. That was your participation in that world. And so from when I was like 15, I would just be like, I think about, you know, I feel this thing, blah, 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 and make some funny drawings and then, you know, scam photocopies at your workplace and send them around and steal stamps. And and so it's like you were like giving people your diary when you're like meeting 15. Them at the Food Not Bombs. So it was like, yeah, for me, it was like, yeah, it was like, I don't know if it's a millennial thing also, like not compartmentalizing. It's like, it's weird because I spend most of my time in a very like staid, hyper professional environment, but I don't know. It's like, you just, it's weird. You just can't be, you know, anyone besides who you are, so it's just what it is. They're just like, okay, she's here with her green hair at the seminar or whatever. But I mean, for me, and then there's just like a definitely like a life, I hope will be a lifelong commitment to investigation of my life. Like, I always, you know, said that my way of processing life, and life is always political, is through writing, and I like need the writing space to do that work. It's like, it's experience will not be metabolized without writing. And so what, and you know, like when I said that the carceral capitalism was an exorcism, like there were all of these things that I was, you know, experiencing, seeing, you know, coming into contact with the carceral state in a very like immediate personal way. There's just something in me that's like, I need to figure out what's going on here. And it was like, yeah, it was just, it's always been like second nature for me. Any thoughts on that? Personal is political?
Yes. I agree.
My question is also for Jackie. So, I wanted to ask you, like, your writing process, since you're writing for a political movement. And so when you're writing, if you sort of just like let your poetic, I guess, muse just flow, or if there's some parts where you stop and you're like, okay, and for this part specifically, I really have to be academic and like tweak it a bit. And if that interrupts you, or if you just flow and fix it later?
That's a good question. It's like, this book is like somewhere between like, I don't, it's like sort of academic, sort of creative, sort of for popular audience. There are definitely like theoretical conversations that have taken place mostly in academia, but are not, you know, exclusive to academia. Like, Afro-pessimism is something that comes out of academia, but, you know, a lot of people, activists, are reading Afro-pessimist theory. And so for me, I was like, on that register, I was trying to bridge multiple traditions. So thinking about using the analytic of racial capitalism to think about the carceral state, but then having to engage these very like tense academic debates between people who are like using racial capitalism as their analytic and people who are using Afro-pessimism. And so there is a little, you know, I've definitely got one foot in that world as well. And some people are like utterly confused about like why I reference the people that I reference, like Rosa Luxemburg, that's like 100 years old. What could she have to say about, what does she have to say that's relevant to like analyzing, you know, racialized expropriation and incarceration and all these things. But I like, it's a similar thing to Lily. It's like, it makes sense to me because I need this, I need to use this book, I need to use this thinker to unpack this thing. So it was weird. I had to create a very strange constellation to do that work. So, you know, I don't want to just reference like the people who are having the debates about racial capitalism and Afro-pessimism, but also like imprison revolutionaries who were generating their own political theory. And so something that I try to do in the introduction is to, you know, think about how, you know, George Jackson, Huey Newton, other Black Power organizers and intellectuals, to think about, you know, what they were saying about capitalism, incarceration, racism, and to really take seriously revolutionaries as political thinkers as well.
This is like a basic question, but first of all, I also really loved and enjoyed your guys' poems, but what has been something challenging when writing this book?
I've never written a book. I wrote like a long chapbook that is like technically a book, but I had to go behind my back because I was like, it's just a chapbook. But there's like, I really credit being in psychoanalysis 4 days a week with helping me get over some of my psychic blocks that prevent me from, you know, finishing things. So it was really, but it was weird because I was like, how the hell did that happen? I don't know. It felt like it was never meant to happen. I don't know. She writes a lot of books.
I think with this book, this is my first book of essays. I've never really written nonfiction, especially in the long form, before. And so that was something I felt. A lot of it was also like this weird guilt because I was writing about my sister's death and her really exceptional life. But I also felt like I was whoring out my sister's death. And so that I felt like a tremendous amount of guilt for that. Like I didn't have a right to write about, like not me. But then I got over that. I think that the hardest thing was hearing Ricky's criticism that I was being like so self-pitying, and like kind of self-indulgent in my self-pitying. But I kind of don't know any other way to be. Like I want to be indulgent in how bad I feel. Like, why is that a bad thing? Like, I feel bad. I feel like all of you should feel bad when I feel bad. No, not right. I worked the most difficult thing in writing this book was just not trying to not feel bad for myself about myself. Like, to work against self-hate. And publicly on the page, like it was therapy on the page, but I don't really condone or practice like, oh, you should use writing as therapy. But in a way I was using writing, as a way to keep myself from just being too self-indulgent in my, like, dislike of myself. But in the end, I think it worked. I think I dislike myself less because of this book. I don't know.
No, I mean, the internal barriers are huge.
Yeah.
Always you're, like, battling yourself when you go to write anything. It's, like, all of the doubt and all of the voices that you internalize, and then the like hypothetical audience and it's just like the it's just
so there's this TED talk about creativity, where this neuropsychologist put like jazz pianists in an fMRI machine and watched them create music. And in it, he found that like part of the prefrontal cortex that is in control of like the self-monitoring, like that voice that tells you that you're fucking up and to stop making a fool of yourself and stop what you're doing, like that shuts down. And then another part of the cerebral cortex lights up, and that's the part that controls self-expression and autobiography. So that in the act of creation is this level of dissociation, which I find just really like fascinating. Ooh. And beautiful.
I wish I had the neurological response of the jazz musicians.
I know.
I feel like when I was like a teenager, it was like, yeah, like everything that I'm saying is just what it is. It's just coming out, and now it's like a much, well, I don't know. I mean,
no,
glorify the youthful lack of self-restraint. I don't think I have that thing neurologically, though, but I've never been tested.
I guess neither have I, but I mean that's what neuroscience says.
They never put you in the fMRI.
No, they never put me in the fMRI machine.
Like write a poem.
Well, I mean, like that's just like neuroscience is still like just poking around stuff.
Yeah. But my little brother and I went to the Exploratorium today, and they have this thing where you can put your two fingers in this thing where it like tells you your emotional reactivity.
What was yours, Jackie?
Oh my gosh, I was like, play Bjork. And I was like so calm when Bjork was on. I was like, and it just was like down, down, down. And then my little brother, there's like cards that you can use to test like your reactivity. They have scenarios and pictures and stuff. And there was this like, this gross foot that with this like open wound on it. And it was just like, whoosh. Like, yeah, so I don't know if what we could go to the Exploratorium and try to write and see. Like,
the cheap way to do the testing.
Yeah, cheap way.
I feel like we should get like an NEA grant to do that.
I know. If you know any neuroscientists, send them our way.
I do know a nurse.
Oh, yeah, you know one. Danny, you had a question?
Danny had a question.
A lot.
Oh, it's kind of a silly question.
Yeah, it was a silly question.
It's a silly question.
I guess.
But, I mean, it doesn't, you don't have to ask that question. You can ask any question.
So, Lily, why why do you attribute yourself of not being a poet?
Yeah, I have this thing that I really don't, I really insist that I'm not a poet. Like, I really insist that I'm, like, a novelist or an essayist. In part because I have a lot of respect for poetry and poets, and I don't think that I do any of the stuff that poets do. And also, I'm not trained as a poet. Like, I don't know.
But do you have the soul of a poet?
I don't know. I don't allow the word soul in any of my workshops.
Really?
Like, someone writes soul, and I'm like, take that out of there.
In Carson! Soul all over.
I know, but she's Anne Carson. I mean,
Du Bois.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, no, but actually, I don't call myself a poet in part because, like, aesthetically, I think that to claim that what I write is an essay or a novel is to push the form of essay or novel. And so I think the easier thing would be to say, oh, I just read you a poem. And it's a harder thing to say that, you know, that thing that just had a fairy tale in the middle of that, that's nonfiction.
Yeah.
And then my second question is for Jackie. How are you so fucking cool and inspiring?
Come
which
on.
We're all wondering that. I thought I was the one that should approach the situation.
I raised this kid.
That's why I'm super cool.
Yeah. I would like spike Danny's hair when he was, oh my gosh, so many funny stories. I would like put him on my shoulders at punk concerts. Sum 41 on his 11th birthday brought him on stage because I made a sign for him that said, "It is my 11th birthday." Landed him in the audience.
I couldn't spell at that point.
Jump kicks.
I still can't.
No, it's just life. Just gotta stay alive. Just gotta stay like aware. I don't know. It's like it's a challenge to not like just be deadened by living.
That is true.
That's like on that positive note. Like, Jackie is cool by virtue of being
because I have a cool brother. Also
ontologically cool.
yeah I feel like that should be your like about me.
I'll have it
ontologically cool
a business card that says just like ontological coolness.
Anybody else have a question?
I would ask Danny that question about Jackie. Like, what do you think why Jackie's like that?
Well, I know where we're from, and so for someone to autonomously become cool is very unlikely. my coolness comes from the older sister, so I don't know where her source is, but I know where mine is. Thursday, the band Thursday.
Oh my gosh, too much screamo music in adolescence. That's where it all comes from.
I'm not that cool.
What was that?
I'm not that cool. I don't let screamo do me anything.
Yeah, I mean, screamo's not cool anymore.
I didn't listen to regular music until I was 18. Like, I don't even know what you guys are talking about. That's how uncool.
Oh my gosh. I was a music journalist first before I was anything else, so. That was, oh yeah, that's how I became cool. Hanging out with musicians. No, but yeah. Who knows? Curiosity. Keep it alive.
Yeah, curiosity. High five to curiosity.
That's what they're trying to keep alive at the Exploratorium.
And then it just turns into an ad for you. I know,
it's like... We love kids at the Exploratorium.
Danny's like, I should get a job there. They let you doodle when you're like, when it's like slow.
No, I talked to my buddy about that.
Like, have a degree in like
being smart or something.
Magnetism.
Yeah.
You actually do, yeah. Even just a scientist.
Really? You need to be a scientist to work there?
Yeah.
My buddy that got us the tickets is he has a bachelor's in physics.
Oh,
grad school and stuff.
It's like, it's kind of the epitome of like how when people, like Americans go to Cuba and they're like, people with PhDs are selling books there.
Oh, yeah.
And you're kind of like...
At the Exploratorium.
You're selling tickets.
Yeah. That person who sold us our ticket was good at drawing because they let you draw in your when it's
like
he's
you
like
doodle?
Been honing his skills.
Yeah,
all the downtime adding up.
First thing I noticed when I was there. I was like,
yeah, Danny's like, that's a sick drawing.
It was. He should be here. Yeah.
I just wanted to express gratitude for this book. I mean, I know it, you know, there's a lot that's gone into it, and I think it's a book that's really needed right now, and just, it's the right time for it.
Thank you.
It's a perfect, and I'm so glad that you agreed immediately to come here and read from it, so I'm just really grateful that
Yeah, thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you.